A very good morning to you. It's Rebecca O'Sullivan here with you on Clare FM this Sunday. And welcome to Hindsight, where we look back at some of the biggest and some of the best stories of the week. Coming up on the show this morning, we look at the COVID situation in the Midwest as cases in Limerick spike. The Minister for Education visited the Banner County to make a much-awaited funding announcement for one Ennis school. And Mike Hanrahan of Stockton's Wing opened up about losing his mother the day a song written in her honour was released. A very busy show indeed this morning. We start, as I mentioned earlier, with the COVID situation in the Midwest, and on Tuesday's Morning Focus, Alan Morrissey was joined by the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan. The CMO gave an in-depth insight into the current situation facing the Midwest region and the risks to Clare posed by the rising COVID cases in Limerick. He also spoke about the recent uproar caused by gangs of people gathering together in cities and here in Clare's coastal areas to drink. He began by speaking about Clare's low case figures.
That's true of any part of the country and not just Clare. You're right to point out those figures in Clare are reassuring in terms of the levels. Like the national average is at about 120 or so per 100,000 over a 14-day period. In Clare, the rates are about half that. So the position for the people living in County Clare is reassuring. But if you're not vaccinated and if you're starting to engage in activities that can facilitate the transmission of this infection, like meeting up indoors and not observing social distance, not using masks where that's appropriate, or going out and about when you have symptoms, things of that nature, any of these kinds of things can facilitate spread. But it's very clear that the people of Clare have been very responsible in how they've been behaving, and their collective behaviour have helped to keep the levels of virus suppressed in the county. But as the experience in Limerick shows, it doesn't take very much, perhaps, for if you look at it like Tinder. You know, a spark can catch very easily with this infection and spread very easily. And so we have to be very careful.
We're watching with interest here in Clare what's happening in Limerick and with Kilkenny and Lahinch. Plenty of people from Limerick go to those places, and there's a lot of interconnection between both counties, people travelling to and from each county to the other, be it for work or school or social reasons, whatever it might be. Clare has generally been good in terms of suppressing the virus, but could our relatively low incidence rate be at risk if that situation in Limerick not only doesn't improve but continues to go further downwards from where it is at the moment, and particularly if there's no localised lockdown?
The situation could change, and if we've learned anything across the world about this virus over the last 15 months, it is that very quickly a situation at a local level can change, and sometimes it doesn't take a very big change in behaviour for that to happen. This is a virus that, unless we're doing things to suppress its spread, can spread very, very easily. It spreads about twice as easily, if not more so, than flu. So it's very, very easy to pass this in person to person. And that's why the measures that we advocate, strict social distancing, people being very careful about hand hygiene, particularly when they've got sniffles and coughs and colds and symptoms like that, staying away from other people, And using masks and staying away from crowds, and in particular avoiding meeting up indoors. They sound like very simple measures, but they have been very effective in keeping this level of suppression that we've seen, that you're seeing in County Clare now, and that many other parts of the country are seeing. And if we can keep that level of suppression while we're continuing to roll out the vaccine to all of the age groups, that'll be the effective means of ultimately giving protection to people, that we'll have measures in place that are complemented by the high levels of vaccination. And we're seeing now in the older age groups a very significant drop off in the numbers of people picking up this infection right around the country, and in the severe effects that people are experiencing right around the country. So these vaccines are working, but we haven't gotten them to everybody yet. And so we really want people to hear the message that keep up the observation of the public health guidance that you've been doing so well until you get to the point of vaccination.
And on vaccinations, a quarter of the country is fully vaccinated, a number which could increase soon. We've seen new advice from NIAC to the HSE that could lead to a reduction in the gap between AstraZeneca vaccine doses from 12 to 8 weeks. So potentially there could be hundreds of thousands of people being fully vaccinated earlier than expected. Between that and the single dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine, is our vaccination programme going to be accelerated?
So I think our vaccine program is going extremely well by international comparison. We've seen, most importantly, very high uptake of the vaccine in all of the age groups to whom it's been offered. We want to continue that. The HSE has been running a major programme with the vaccine delivery to ensure that the only thing that slows down, if you like, or constrains the delivery of the programme is the rate at which we're able to get our hands on supplies of the vaccine. And we're continuing to see significant supplies of the vaccine come in, particularly in relation to the so-called mRNA vaccines, and the most numerous one of which is the Pfizer vaccine. And getting those vaccines out to people as quickly as possible is obviously the key priority. There is a consideration now, you're right to say, been given to bringing forward the timing of the second dose, which relates to some of the concern that has been raised with the experience seen in the UK in relation to this so-called Delta variant, what was being called the Indian variant up until very recently, which does appear to spread more easily than the dominant strain that we had and that the UK had up until this point. We know that the UK has a greater challenge in terms of the rate of that infection that they're experiencing at the moment than we do. And they're also using a different profile of vaccines in broad terms than us. But they have a higher percentage of the population vaccinated. So it will, as you rightly say, be important that we do everything we can to try and get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible.
Another key part of that, Tony, is are the pharmacies, and more than 1,000 of them have applied to be involved in the vaccination programme. Stephen Donnelly says they'll begin playing a role in vaccinations from early this month, which can only help with the acceleration of the programme.
Yes, and we want to see, and that will also make it easier for people in getting access to vaccine as well if we have more points of potential vaccination. We'll be doing everything we can to try and ensure that we have as much delivery capacity as possible. As I say, that just the supply of the vaccine is the only reason or the only constraint on the delivery of the programme. And so for anybody who's listening, if you've been called to register or you've been called for a vaccine, it's really important that you respond. These vaccines are really effective, and we can already see the effectiveness of these vaccines in the impact of this disease in the people who've been vaccinated, which is really good news.
You mentioned the Delta variant, the more infectious Indian variant. How at risk are we from it, and how concerned are you by its potential impact, particularly with the reopening of foreign travel next month in mind?
We have a number of measures in place to try to minimise the risk of it being imported, measures at the point of entry, and we have measures in place then to ensure that there is effective contact tracing when we pick up these cases, and then we also carry out ongoing testing across the country. We think we've seen a number of importations of this strain, but nothing like what's been experienced in the UK. In the most recent weekly data that we track in terms of looking at the percentage of the cases that are attributable to this variant, we think it might be of the order of about 2% at the moment, whereas it's well in excess of 50%, maybe 60, 70% in the UK as things stand. That doesn't mean we should be complacent. It does tell us that some of the measures we have in place to slow this this variant down are having an effect on its growth. But if we see, let's say, any change in our the measures that we have in place, it could lead to an increase. I mean, it's true to say that any variant that is spread much more easily than a previous variant is going to, given the right conditions, become dominant. The key thing for us is to slow down that as much as we can while getting people vaccinated, because we do know the evidence so far is, although there have been some questions raised about vaccine effectiveness with this variant, these vaccines that we are using will be effective against this particular variant. That's our current belief. And so therefore, slowing it down while we get people vaccinated is our key objective now.
I'm sure, Tony, you're aware HICWA published findings that could stretch the period of immunity post-infection from 6 to 9 months. So what's your take on that and the ramifications in terms of, as we mentioned, the acceleration of the vaccine rollout? And if immunity does last 9 months instead of six, could we be looking at booster shots 9 months down the road instead of six?
Well, we're still trying to answer the question about what might happen in terms of booster shots. But you're right to say that the immunity has been increased to 9 months, because the studies that have tracked people and how long and persistent their level of antibody protection is after having the infection show that it lasts as long as 9 months. In fact, the data that's been published around this is really encouraging. It shows that there's really very little drop-off in the level of protection evident in those studies. So our anticipation is that when we follow those studies forward and there's been 12 months of follow-up, that we might well be extending that 9 months to 12 months. The implication of that would be for people who've had an infection in the last now 9 months and where it was PCR confirmed with a laboratory test. that means you can regard yourself as being protected until at least 9 months. And so some of those people will obviously be people who have yet to been offered vaccination, and they can regard themselves as being protected because the infection, the natural infection, has given them that protection for at least 9 months. Our big surge in cases in this country, as you know, Alan, was in January, February, March of this year.
Yeah.
And so we're still well within 9 months of that. So people who picked up that infection during that time period can regard themselves as being protected until October, November, December of this year. That's the implication. And we'll be well down the road of vaccination by the time we get to that part of the year.
Tony, I've touched on Kilkee and Lahinch. They were busy last weekend and there were issues which we covered on the show around people not maintaining social distance and antisocial behaviour. You recently tweeted your concern about recent large gatherings on South William Street in Dublin. How can we, or is there a way to safely maintain large gatherings other than offering advice or closing down amenities, which isn't an ideal option either?
Well, we think the way to do it is to step our way into reintroducing gatherings, but to start at an appropriate size. So we already have advised government, and government has decided to introduce gatherings of up to 100 people in outdoor settings taking place, still advising people to maintain social distance and to use masks and so on in those kinds of environments. And then if that goes well for us, we'd increase that to 200 for the month of July. That's the intention of government, and that's the advice that we gave them. And then after that, if we get through July well, we should be in a position then to see even larger numbers or percentages of the total attendance at, for example, a sports ground being possible. But if we start by having the very large gatherings right at the very beginning, the risk there is that we'll only set back the progress that we've made. What we have to do is to kind of step ourselves through it carefully. So we start with a safe number, and when we know that that has, let's say, happened successfully, hasn't led to a significant increase in transmission, we know it'll be safe to move on to the next step. And a careful but ambitious stepwise way through the easing restrictions is what we've been following now for a number of months, and we've seen the level of infection in the population overall staying very steady. And if we can hold to that path as a country, we're optimistic that we can get through it safely. But if we start having very, very large gatherings now, we think that that's just too early.
Tony, I mentioned that Clare has been pretty good at suppressing the virus, but what's your view on how Clare has handled COVID generally, I suppose, across the 15 or 16 months of this extraordinary situation we and the rest of the world find ourselves in?
Well, I think around the country, people have done a really fantastic job. There is a bit about Limerick, there is a bit of there, but for the grace of God, because the reality is when this infection gets a hold, it can spread very easily, and the level of behaviour or the change in behaviour that it can take to turn a very controlled situation into something that's very uncontrolled may not be very much indeed. It's not the case that we find ourselves as a country where people in one county are very abstemious and very careful observers of public health guidance, and people in other counties are completely reckless in how they. That's not the case. Very small differences in the way in which populations socialise can produce big differences in the level of infection that we see. And that's why it's important that we all keep up those high levels of public health observation and practice that we've seen over the course of the 15 months, while people are getting sick and tired, I'm quite sure, of these measures, and very understandably so. Mm. Nevertheless, people have kept up a very, very high standard of good observation of the public health guidance. That's clearly been happening in Clare, clearly been happening in many other parts of the country. But as I say, the difference between like what might be happening in Limerick now and what might be happening in other parts of the country can often be because of just small amounts of difference in terms of behaviour. And so it's the opportunity for us to remind people that like meeting up indoors, social gatherings, these are the conditions that this virus loves to spread, and we need to avoid this at this point in time.
Just to finish, Tony, we've spoken about elements that could lead to the acceleration of the vaccination programme, the reduction in the gap between the doses of AstraZeneca, the single shot Johnson & Johnson, the pharmacies getting involved in it as well. What point do you feel the numbers have to reach before we can kind of say we're out of the woods, so to speak, or that we're nearing the finish line? Is it the vaccination numbers we should focus on? That seems to have been where the focus has moved since the vaccination programme began. We talk about the percentage of the population or adult population that's been vaccinated, or is it still about case numbers?
It'll be about both, and we look at the case numbers and in a particular case numbers that are happening as to whether they're happening in unvaccinated people or vaccinated people. And we know that it can be possible for this virus to be picked up by people even if they've had a vaccine, because no vaccine gives you 100% protection. But for the most part, our intention will be to get as far through the adult population as quickly as possible. We've seen really good uptake. I'm certain that when we get through this, we'll discover that the Irish people are taking up this vaccine at as high, if not a higher rate than almost anywhere else in the world, which we know will translate into really good protection for all of us, which is good news. And we'll keep that going until we get through all of the adult population. There are some questions that we will be examining as to whether there is a need for us to consider vaccination when we go through all of the adult groups into adolescence, for example. Those decisions aren't made at this point in time, but we will look at those. But we would like to get what we call the level of herd immunity, the total percentage of the population that has been vaccinated, to get that as high as possible. The government has purchased enough vaccine, and the HSE have enough capacity to ensure that everybody who turns up for vaccination, for whom it's recommended, can be vaccinated. And our goal would be to try and get as many of those vaccinated as quickly as possible.
Welcome back to Hindsight here on Clare FM this Sunday morning with myself, Rebecca O'Sullivan. On Tuesday, the Minister for Education, Norma Foley, visited Clare. Her first stop was to Gaelscoil Mhíl Cuisóg in Ennis, where she announced funding for a much-anticipated new general-purpose hall for the growing student population. In a boost for parents of children with special educational needs, funding has also been allocated for the first-ever early intervention units at a mainstream school in the town. Clare FM's Sally Ann Barish was there on the day, and she spoke to Principal Donal O'Hanafain, excited pupils, and of course, the minister herself. Let's have a listen. That was the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, speaking on Tuesday's Morning Focus to Alan Morrissey in an in-depth interview covering the precarious situation in the Midwest regarding the virus, an outdoor summer, and concerns over large groups socialising. Now, coming up, the Education Minister, Norma Foley, visited Clare on Tuesday to deliver good news to one Ennis school, and our own Sally Ann Barrett went along. We'll bring you that just after the break.
With 481 students currently enrolled, Gaelscoil Mhíl Cuisóg is one of the most rapidly developing schools in Clare. But growing pupil numbers coupled with COVID restrictions has been putting intense pressure on school facilities. While the school had already secured funding for 7 new classrooms, the campaign for a new HALA, or general purpose room, and 2 new early intervention units for children with special educational needs continued. Yesterday, after a long-running campaign, Principal Donal O'Hanafain finally got what the student population had been waiting for.
Well, what the minister announced is on top of a 7, we already had been granted a 7 classroom extension with 2 special education rooms under a devolved grant scheme. And the difficulty or the challenge that we faced was that under that devolved grant scheme, it was impossible to get money allocated for a general purpose room, even though it had happened in the past and we had evidence of that. And in our negotiations with them, we made it clear that this had happened in the past. However, it was very challenging because additional accommodation schemes were for classroom accommodation only. But this intervention by the minister in announcing the HALA and the double early intervention AASD unit is really, really positive, because it means that we're at stage 2A of the process. All of that work and planning has been done. We're at the position now where we can actually put in one planning application to the local authority for the complete development. So obviously we have to go back and revisit the work that's been done and make sure that, but it's one planning application, which we're hoping will happen during this year. And then you're going out to tender, after a number of months after receiving your planning, etc. So I'm hopeful that we'll see work happening on the ground here in the school year 22-23, that some of that work will be happening here. And we will have temporary accommodation in the meantime, which we've already been granted also, temporary prefab accommodation to cover us during the build. So the school is at its apex now from a numbers perspective. This is the replacement of substandard temporary accommodation that we have here at the side of the school and at the back of the school, rented prefab accommodation, and also the small rooms in the school that they're special education rooms, but we've been using them as classrooms because we were hoping to get this over the line very, very quickly, and it took a little longer than we anticipated. So we're delighted about that. It's one planning application, one major build, finishing out the complex, future-proofing the school at its current enrolment level.
So the current enrolment level?
We have 481 pupils enrolled in the school on September last. We have 67 pupils leaving Rangashe this year, and we're taking in about 62 pupils into our infant intake. So our enrolment is going to stay roughly at that level over the next number of years. We are not going to become a 600 or a 700 pupil school, okay? The enrolment in Ennis is generally to fall, that we believe, over the next number of years anyway, according to the demographics. But the demographics have been wrong in the past as well, because Ennis manages to attract young families and manages to attract families from all over County Clare into the Midwest corridor. So I could see Ennis still growing. It'll be interesting to see when the Ennis 2040 plan is launched, what impact that will have on the development of Ennis. And certainly we believe there's room for another second level provider in the town to give extra choice to all of those families, and hopefully that will be an independent Gaelfaoch Dunclawr in the future, in the years ahead.
Cathy Sanandich.
Oren is far the sanum dum augustis data made Gwesgol vehicles so gig inish.
Can I just ask you, what's your reaction to the minister's announcement today of this funding for your school?
I think that's great, especially for the future students, especially for sport when it's raining outside.
How difficult has it been to not have a facility like that at the moment?
It's kind of hard when we're playing sport outside after school, and then when it starts raining, we have nowhere to go to play, and we just have to wait inside.
She friendly ogana sanam dum. Tomé do yag bin a dish August timer school gudi gwell school vihil kisog.
And Shifra, what does it mean to hear that the new sports hall and the additional facilities will be coming to your school?
I mean, it's absolutely great because we would use it so much because, I mean, we're just in such a small hall right now and we're just unable to use it due to COVID. But it would be so great because we're kind of just depending on the weather the whole time to play sports and stuff. So it'd just be great to have it.
While the construction of the sports hall will be welcome to many students, the addition of two early intervention units is a unique development. For parents of children with special education needs, they will be the first ever early intervention units at a mainstream school in the town of Ennis. Education Minister Norma Foley says the pending developments at the Gaelscoil are testament to the school's determination to get these facilities in place.
There has been very strong, you know, I suppose, commitment from the entire school team here, and I want to acknowledge that. And the ongoing engagement with the Department of Education has been very positive. And it's also very important to say as well that this school has grown and developed spectacularly in the last long number of years. And again, that's a tribute to the to the excellent work that goes on here on a daily basis within this school. But I'd like to acknowledge that throughout the length and breadth of Clare, really, it has been nothing short of phenomenal what has been achieved by schools on the ground throughout this past 18 months. It has been particularly challenging in school environments, but, you know, the response and the generosity of heart and spirit from school communities has been just astounding. And as Minister for Education, I want to not just acknowledge it, but celebrate it as well. And I think it's a remarkable achievement in very, very difficult times, unprecedented times in terms of COVID-19, that we have successfully managed to keep our schools open, albeit when there was a necessity, we'll say after Christmas there, to move to remote teaching and learning. That was achieved as well. So I think maybe the lens has refocused itself in terms of wider society appreciating the sterling work that goes on in our schools on a daily basis and the importance of education, not just from an academic and learning point of view, but also from the well-being point of view as well for our children and young people. So as we reach this point, almost the conclusion of the school year, at primary level and the conclusion, I suppose, at second level and the beginning of the written exams, we're very conscious that, you know, a job has been well done by the education sector.
Minister, you mentioned that the state exams do indeed begin. Do you have a message for the students of Clare who will be partaking? I'm sure they're probably concerned that they will avoid any of the mistakes that happened last year.
Well, I would like to take the opportunity to wish the students of Clare, and indeed all students, every possible good luck and good fortune tomorrow. They have been a remarkably resilient class, the class of 2021. They have met many, many challenges, but they have shown tremendous courage, and I think we should celebrate that courage, determination and focus, and a willingness really to almost reimagine and reconfigure, I suppose, their experience of education. And again, that is due to the leadership as well of school communities who have assisted them, and indeed their families. I'm always very conscious, you know, I come from a teaching background myself, and I know when a student or a child or a young person in the house is taking a leaving certificate, we're all taking the Leaving Cert yet again. It's kind of like it's a repetitive thing every year. So I want to acknowledge that. I also want to acknowledge that many, many students have chosen to avail of the accredited grades process. So this year we had two options or two processes running simultaneously for students. So the accredited grades process and also the option of the written exam. And I'm very pleased that more than 91% of students have actually opted for both. So they're giving themselves the best possible opportunity going forward. And I think that's to be welcomed. Well, there is currently a review of senior cycle. And when I say senior cycle, I would refer there now to transition year, LCVP programmes, Leaving Certificate Applied, and the established Leaving Cert, or the traditional Leaving Cert as we would call it. So there has been a substantial body of work already done, and that report has now just arrived, and there will be a further opportunity for public consultation on that. Again, part of the strategy is very clear, and I have made it very clear since I've become Minister last June now, that we need an education system that caters for all needs, and that provides, particularly at senior cycle, provides a pathway forward for every young person, irrespective of the path that they might choose. So there is a job of work. There is much that works very, very well in senior cycle as it stands. There's always the opportunity to do things better or to do things afresh and to do things anew, particularly, you know, in the 21st century now, we're looking at new opportunities. I think we would never have imagined all that we achieved over the past 18 months in terms of education, how we reimagined the delivery of education, particularly from a digital point of view, how, you know, the incredible, I suppose, ingenuity and creativity of those in the classrooms, teachers, SNAs, principals, deputy principals, boards of management, you know, how in a short space of time, when I would say backs were to the wall, that they still ensured that the provision of education was given a top priority. So I'm very much so looking forward to this review of senior cycle. And it's a review that is welcoming of all points of view, and so it's extended to wider society, not just those who work within the education sector, not just those who are serviced by the education sector, but the widest possible experience of society.
That was the Minister for Education, Norma Foley, and before her, excited students and the principal, of course, as well, of Gaelscoil Mhíle Cuisóg, Donal O'Hanafáin, speaking to Clare FM's Sally Ann Barrett about the announcement of funding for a general purpose hall and the first ever early intervention units at a mainstream school in Ennis. Fantastic news for the school. Minister Foley also commenting, as you heard just there, ahead of the Leaving Cert beginning this week, and responding to questions as to whether the state exams should be overhauled, something which former Education Minister Simon Harris has called for. Now, coming up after this break, we'll hear from Mike Hanrahan of Stockton's Wing. Mike spoke this week about raising money for the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland through a song penned in honour of his mother's journey with dementia and how she sadly passed away the day it was released. Stay tuned to hear his story and the song itself. Welcome back to the final part of this morning's Hindsight here on Clare FM this Sunday with myself, Rebecca O'Sullivan. Now, on Thursday's morning Focus, Alan Morrissey was joined by Mike Hanrahan from Stockton's Wing. The Ennis native came on the show to speak about his newly penned song A River Rolls On, one of the first songs that Hanrahan has penned in some time. The track is inspired by his mother's experiences with vascular dementia. The single was released on Friday the 28th of May in collaboration with the Forget Me Nots Choir, who are an inclusive community choir that unite those living with memory loss issues with their carers, families and friends. The track features Lisa Lamb, Sandy Kelly and more, and with musical arrangements by Nora Constance Walsh. However, on the day the track was released, Mike's mother passed away, but not before hearing the song. The song is available to download on the Forget Me Nots Choir's Bandcamp, with all the proceeds going to the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland to fund creative activities through ASI centres and communities countrywide. And Mike began on Thursday by telling Alan about losing his mother the day of the release.
Yeah, that's a very sad part about it, but the song itself has got a lot of positive connotations, and the fact that I got to work with the Forget Me Nots Choir is really good, and it's positive, because what we really want to achieve is a more open and discussion and more inclusivity for those people who are living with memory loss issues, and especially those who are caring for them, and that was the whole purpose. So it was a bit bizarre that mum passed on the day it was released. Perhaps that was her wish for me, for the song and all of us involved in it. Yes, we've been extremely sad, and we're mourning the loss of a great woman, but I really have to carry on with this now in her name and in her honour, and try and develop more interest in it. And that's what I'm doing. And I'm being introduced to so many different people around the world globally who really believe that music has a great healing power for people with dementia and other memory loss issues. And I'm beginning to develop a knowledge base and a lot of friendships as well, so that we will in time come up with a few more great ideas to maybe introduce and offer to people here in Ireland who might find music and dance and arts generally, because they do say that the arts, the scientists are saying now that the arts gives dignity to those people with memory loss issues, and the scientists are turning to the artists more and more and more for us to get involved and help them out on developing some way through this really horror disease that has kind of overwhelmed our generation and our parents.
I have to say, Mike, it's great to see you bringing this song out and raising funds for the organisations that you're raising the money for. I know certainly in my own life, my grandfather passed away and had Alzheimer's, and it's such a cruel and I think undignified way to go as well, to watch someone deteriorate and waste away before your very eyes in a kind of a drawn out process.
Yes, and that's really what the purpose of I've got involved with a bunch of people with the brain research in Ireland that they've taken me in and asked me to get involved with them, and we're going to try and develop some areas to give that dignity back to them, because even only yesterday I was looking at a video of a guy with Alzheimer's, and somehow he discovered that he was a flower arranger in his late years, and his creativity and his focus now each day is creating flowers for different homes around his area. So, and it just goes to show music itself, if people, a lot of people will reintroduce themselves to their childhood piano lessons and start playing, and that's happening as well. And that's really what I'm talking about, giving back the dignity to people, because I saw my mother transgressed through the disease over 7 years, and 4 years at Caracalla in the garden wing, which was really great. They looked after us so beautifully out there, and I want to pay tribute to those people. So that's really my purpose now. And I've met this amazing woman in New York, Magda, and she's a dance tutor and an advocate for aging through dance. And we will come up with some really nice ideas, I think.
7 years, that's such an incredibly long time.
Yes, yeah, it was a long, slow journey for her, but she always had a great dignity and a lady and a beautiful woman that she always was, and she reared 8 kids, and we were there for her, looking after her, and we were there at the end. And yeah, she was a tough woman, a great heart, and I have to say, I must pay a tribute to the people of Venice, because the funerals are just such. We were really privileged that we got to see our mum, and we got to bury her with dignity. And we had people were allowed in the church. So many people weren't over the last 18 months. But what happened on the streets were the people, hundreds and hundreds of people, lined the streets, and in some instances they applauded mum into the church and out of the church. And it was just, I really want to say thanks to the people of Venice. They were tremendous in our grief.
Mike, it must have been a very emotional scene when you were playing the song for your mum. But I'm sure ultimately you were delighted that she got to hear it.
Yes, I was thrilled. And I remember a couple of months ago, maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago, myself and Kieran, my brother, who's a musician, most people would know him now, and Claire, we went down to visit and we brought our instruments in and we played. And I sang that song for her there that day as well. And you have to believe that people hear, even in the last throes of, because hearing is the last organ that leaves. And so you have to kind of believe that people are listening to you and hearing you. So it's really important that we all... And my older brother, Joe, who's tremendous, he actually just on her, put the phone to her ear and played the song, and it was a kind of a special moment, really.
Mike, the song itself, I think of musicians who've written songs about family members or about sad circumstances. One that comes to mind, I suppose, Eric Clapton, who, you know, Tears in Heaven is famously about his young son, Connor, who tragically died. And I wonder how he feels when he plays that song. Does he get emotional? Does it make him feel sad? Or is it an opportunity every night that he plays it on stage to remember his son and keep him in his heart? Is that the kind of way you're viewing A River Rolls On and how you'll feel about it when, I suppose, gigs become a thing again and you do decide to play it in front of an audience?
I think so. I wrote a song for my dad 20 years ago after he died, a song called Firefighter, and it allows me to bring him to my gig. He's at all my gigs, so I introduce him and talk about him before I sing the song. So he's very much on my shoulder for the gigs. And I guess from now on, my mum will be balancing on the other shoulder and keeping me on the straight and narrow, making sure I behave myself on stage. So yeah, it will be a great release. And I also think when you write songs, you give out a song, it's not yours anymore. It's for the people who listen. And if the song touches people, then as a songwriter, that's your greatest success.
That was Mike Hanrahan of Stockton's Wing fame speaking to Alan Morrissey on Thursday's Morning Focus. Mike opened up about losing his mother the day he released a song to raise funds for the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland in her memory. A River Rolls On, as you'll hear in just a few moments' time, was penned by Hanrahan in honour of his mother and released in collaboration with the Forget Me Nots Choir, as I said, an inclusive choir made up of those who suffer with memory loss issues, their carers, families and friends, and also features Lisa Lamb, Sandy Kelly, amongst others, with musical arrangements by Nora Constance Walsh. The song is available to be downloaded from the Forget Me Nots Bandcamp, with all proceeds going to the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland in order to raise funds for creative activities through ASI centres and communities countrywide. And I do want to thank Mike for taking the time out to talk to us about this project. It's not an easy thing to speak so soon after his mother's passing. He is now dedicated to devoting his time to raising awareness and funds for dementia and Alzheimer's, an incredible thing to do to continue to honour his mother. Now, that's nearly all the time I have left on this morning's edition of Hindsight, an incredibly busy programme as promised. I won't be here next week. I'm off on my hollybops, or as they call it now, a staycation. And Sally Ann Barrett, who you heard from earlier on the show when she went out to meet the Minister of Education, Norma Foley, she'll be here next week to bring you another edition of Hindsight, where she too will look back at some of the biggest and some of the best stories of the week. And I'll be with you then the week after next. But before I go, I'll leave you with the song itself, A River Rolls On, by Mike Hanrahan, the Forget Me Nots Choir, and a host of other musical guests. Enjoy, stay safe, and I'll talk to you very soon.
A river rolls on to the sea, far away from the high mountain stream, to that place where you long to be. A river rolls on to the sea, down through the hills and the glade. You roll on through sunshine and rain, round the oak and the willow you came. Even the birds sing your name,
They're singing this song for you now. In their hearts, you forever live on and on. They sing of your grace and your joy as you gently go rolling by. Tear and a smile.
Where the river falls to the sea, by the shoreline, ocean breeze, it's there you will set your heart free.
Where the river falls to the sea.
Go now, your time here is done. Time to stop lingering on.
Ocean breeze, where the river falls to the sea. It's where you long to be now. Roll along, roll on. Soon you'll be with you there. Breathe in the salt and the air. Remember the moments we shared.
Remember the moments shared.
So go set your sail and sail away. Sail away. Sail away. The river falls to the sea.
We're singing this song for you now. In our hearts, you forever live on and on.
We sing of your grace and your joy as you gently go rolling by. With a tear and a smile. Roll on by.
Roll on by.
Roll on.
Roll on.
Roll on.
Roll on.
A river rolls on to the sea.
A
river rolls on to the sea. The river rolls on to the sea, the river falls to the sea.